My name is Jeremy Brown, Chair of the CFA Society of Sydney Professional Learning Committee and Managing Director at Alliance Bernstein Australia. It's with great pleasure that I introduce today's conversation between Ian Patrick, CIO of SunSuper, and Jeff Warren, Associate Professor at the College of Business and Economics at the Australian National University and Fund Convener of the ANU Student Managed Fund, to discuss Jeff's recent contribution to the Financial Analyst Journal, Identifying Hedge Fund Skill by Using Peer Cohorts, co-authored with David Forsberg and David Gallagher in the second quarter of this year in the 77th volume of the journal. The journal is a resource available to all CFA charterholders. In putting today's session together, it struck us that many might not know the influential role played by Australian academics and authors in relation to the journal. For instance, were you aware that Stephen Brown was the prior executive editor of the journal? Or did you know that we've had more than 8 contributions just in the last few years by Australian academics and authors? With this in mind, we thought we'd bring some research to life that has been published by an Australian academic. We thought this would suit the podcast method of delivery and that it would be terrific to have a senior member of our local investment society lead the conversation with our local academic. To that end, here on Zoom from lockdown in Sydney, I am very happy to introduce Ian and Jeff today to discuss how we can better identify hedge fund skill. Ian, over to you.
Thanks, Jeremy. And Jeff, it's exciting to be part of a trailblazing initiative with the first CFA Society of Sydney podcast. And as a practitioner, reading your paper was particularly stimulating because manager selection is, after all, the name of the game in our world. And any tool that enables a better outcome from that process is to be welcomed. And I note it's not just your first contribution to the FAJ, but in fact, your third. So you've indeed been productive. Before we launch into the content of the piece that appeared in the FAJ, I'm intrigued to understand, as a non-contributor myself, what galvanizes you to initiate what is a significant body of work like the one that on hedge fund skill using peer cohorts?
I'd like to say I initiated it, but David Forsberg on the paper, it was his PhD. It came out of that. I had a lot to do with taking it through to publication because David is off working in a fund manager in the UK now. But basically, it was his work. And most of the analysis is David's. He did an excellent job.
Oh, excellent. And that partly answers what was going to be my next question, which is how do authors come together? Why David and David? Why not David, Ian, and Jeremy? What traditionally brings authors together for a piece like this?
I often say you should choose who you work with, but I think they chose me in this case. So David Gallagher was David Forsberg's formal supervisor. So usually when you do a PhD, you have a supervisor or a panel of supervisors looking after you. And I mentioned the word panel because there's not often one. And I was invited to be part of the panel, as they call it, to support this type of research. I give my background in doing research in the fund management area, and you know, a little bit of industry experience doesn't hurt. So I was invited on. It was a pleasure, I must say.
Yeah, so this has been a journey for the three of you in coming to the FAJ. It has a history behind it that speaks volumes, I think, about the quality, perhaps, of the conclusions. So if you were to do the dinner table summation of what the study constitutes and what its findings were, what would be that dinner table introduction?
Well, I don't know that I'd quite dish it up at our dinner table at home, but let me just sort of give the how an industry practitioner might look at it. What we're looking at here is identification of hedge managers who are skilled. When you look at a lot of the literature in funds management, what they tend to do is strip out factor exposures and say, you know, apart from the factor exposure, do we see any evidence of underlying skill? You know, selections of stocks and so on. Now, the hedge fund space is quite different. It's a seething mass of strategies, if I could put it like that. It's not factor exposures per se. There's a lot of different strategies in there, a whole range of them. And so you really need to get down to the strategy level, I think, to understand what's going on. the intuition behind what we're doing is to try and identify individual strategies by looking at how the returns are correlated, a very simple measure, and then benchmark each fund against its peer group. And when you do that, you find that the funds that have outperformed their peer group continue to do so for the next 3 to 4 years. And that's quite a period of time. That's a meaningful period of time if you were, you know, if you're trying to do manager selection. That's what we do, and it seems to add some value. The second thing that you can do is when you actually divide up the strategies, you have now a view across the hedge fund universe. You can sort of actually see the type of strategies that are there, which managers sit within it. And that's quite different to just sort of taking, you know, over the broad sectors such as equity, long, short, or even some of the more granular definitions that you get in the hedge fund providers. So it's a different view. And I think of essentially one that's intuitive to me and seems to be successful in delivering to purpose.
Jeff, the one thing that we all know is that the quality of conclusions is only as good as the quality of the data you get in. I can imagine that data here was a tedious exercise given the breadth and the extent of history and the idiosyncratic nature, as you point out in the paper, of backfilled performance histories and the like. Was it an absolute mission just to get the data right, or have databases evolved to the point where that's become less of a problem?
What David did was merge together a couple of databases, and probably the biggest hurdle was that you have overlapping strategies within the same manager and overlapping strategies across the two databases. So weeding some of that out and making sure that you're identifying a unique strategy of a particular manager, I think, was the main hurdle. Otherwise, we're just trying to get returns and collected some of the other data about those strategies that is available in those databases. But I think the main thing was trying to identify unique funds.
Yeah, and you touched on there the fact that if you looked at an index provider like Hedge Fund Research or any of those, they'd have a classification of hedge funds into various strategy groupings. Are you saying that that view is perhaps a useful view for marketing or other purposes, but completely unuseful for determining alpha and persistence of that alpha in hedge fund strategies?
Yeah, that's what we're basically saying. Not completely useless, but pretty blunt, I'd say. The other thing you discover is when you start to go into the different hedge fund databases, they all got their own categories and they're quite different. You know, we looked at a couple of databases, we combined them, and we found that basically when you're doing that, that the taxonomy that they all use are quite different. So you don't have one unique one. The other thing is, if you actually think about the equity long short space, for instance, you could do that many different ways. You could be a momentum style fund. You could be a value style fund. You could be growth style, for instance. You could have an equity style built within that to get the equity long short. So you wouldn't want to just take that category to work out which managers you should be comparing against each other. By using a simple correlation measure, I think you actually have a better shot at forming groups that are meaningful.
There's a good discussion in the paper of contrasting the use of factor analysis as a means of explaining and distinguishing hedge fund strategies and their performance, and the benefits of the correlation approach relative to the factor-based approach. Could you expand a little bit more on what you discovered there?
Well, they have a seven-factor model. That's the common one used. There's a number of them, but the seven-factor one is a common one, and it tries to reduce it all to seven factors. So things like equity market factor, small cap, a couple of momentum style factors in there, and some bond factors, right? It's too blunt. There was some research before ours in the academic research that's talking about how those factor models are not very good at identifying the exposures within the individual funds themselves. They do a lot of different things, right? In a more technical term, they call them the mitted variable problem. That is that you're trying to run regressions to work alpha with seven indicators, but there's a lot more other things that explain hedge fund returns. So we sort of tested our method against that. And you find that alpha, when you measure it using a factor model, disappears after about one or two quarters. So the persistence is very short term. And it looks like the factor model is, it generates a higher alpha. And what we think we got there is a four is forms of beta masquerading as alpha. Whereas when you use the cohort model, as we call it, the alpha disappears. And what it's telling you is that cohort model is mopping out a lot of commonalities that exist in hedge funds that relates to just the strategy being applied itself. And so what we think it does is then by dealing with the omitted variable problem, as I put it, is that you end up identifying the true underlying alpha better.
Now, the one thing that intrigued me as I read through the paper was in a, let's call it a quant equity long short context, the stationarity of that strategy through time in a correlation-based grouping or whatever, I'd fully buy and I'd fully anticipate the stationarity. But a multi-PM macro strategy, I would be left as a prior with some questions about the stationarity within a correlation grouping. So the question then comes to me, well, isn't the universe completely changed? Isn't it going through constant change? And therefore, is a method like this actually allowing you to identify alpha and actually allowing you to build a portfolio with persistence of alpha?
That's a really good question. And we found that when we've put up our paper for review by academics, that's nearly the first question that gets asked. Isn't this all unstable? Doesn't it constantly change? The first thing I would say is it works better than other methods. It appears to add value by forming cohorts or peer groups using correlation better than anything else. So it has some justification in itself. The question is, do we actually mop up the instability in the hedge fund universe adequately? And we do a number of different things within the paper, such as trying to sort of form groups based on a shorter term return window. By the way, we form it on a long-term return window since the start. The long-term return window start seems to work better, which is quite interesting, I think. And you might think, well, why is that the case if you've got a lot of instability? What I suspect, we don't know this for sure, you mentioned, say, global macro. So if you looked at global macro funds over the long run, they might form a group. But if you look in the short run, they could be all breaking away doing different things. So we think that maybe there is a tendency for hedge funds to operate within a certain grouping, but they will diverge in the short run and they'll go and chase different things and then come back together. And then when you look at it over the long run, we think we're getting a better look through to what the actual groupings are.
Right. And which identifies, just because it struck me at the time, there was reference to 24 months in the paper, a look back over 24 months. At the time, I thought to myself, gee, that's short. Just draw out the 24 months distinction between the longer term that you discussed there.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, to make that clear, the correlations between funds which are used to form the cohorts or peer groups are based on the whole series of data. But at any point of time, we estimate their factor exposures over 24 months. And we also, similar to running a factor model, you run a regression of the return of the fund on their cohort, and that's done over 24 months. So what we're trying to do is capture the exposures they're carrying to either their group, which is a measure of the strategy, or to the factors over the most recent period.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks, Jeff. If I was sitting around the table chatting to my team, who are paid and get pleasure, I will admit, from talking to managers and going through the manager identification process through interaction as much as quantitative inputs, they'd say, oh, there are a lot of other variables there unaccounted for. The culture of an organization, the stability of the personnel, the stability of their client base, all number of operational factors. Do you think that's embedded somewhere in the explanatory power of the correlation cohort model?
I'm not sure. I'd probably turn that around and look at it look at it differently. I would say this cohort model might be a good starting place, and it might be a good adjunct to doing in-depth manager research. I think ultimately you have to do that. You know, a quant method is never going to give you the answer. As I said at the outset, there's two things you get from doing this. One is you see the groups in the market, and therefore you can sort of actually probably target your manager research. If I'm interested in this strategy, you know, we have another way of putting funds into the same strategy bucket. So it's a style research type of thing if you want. And secondly, we can go in with the knowledge that at least in the hedge fund sector, those funds that have done better in the past tend to do better in the future. Just with that knowledge, I think that's a good starting point, but then the manager research comes into play because, you know, you've got to be careful when the staff change, or, you know, if there's a star manager there, they're not there anymore. If they've grown too large, relates to capacity, you've got to be wary of that as well. So all those things come into play. So I'm a big believer that manager research has to be done that way and can't be done through purely quant.
But what I think is critically important, there is such a broad waterfront in hedge fund space, as you call out, and the ability to parse that waterfront and choose your targets for ongoing deeper due diligence is absolutely crucial. And this is where a technique such as the one covered in the paper is hugely important. I'm interested in the, let's call it the outliers, the funds that never quite sat neatly in a cohort, and how you dealt with those in the research, and how we might think of them in a practitioner context in incorporating them into an overall portfolio of hedge fund strategies.
Yes, that's a very good question, and quite an interesting result there. So 30 or 40% of the funds don't sit in a cohort. It's a form of cluster analysis, right? So we apply a correlation cutoff. And if you don't form a group within the correlation cutoff, you're on your own, right? You're an orphan fund or a unique fund. The first thing to note is we find that those funds appear to deliver better performance, which is interesting because it tells you there's something in uniqueness. Perhaps it's they don't run into capacity constraints, or they don't have as much competition for opportunities. That appears to cause better performance. The second thing is we also extended the test to say, let's take those individual funds and add them to the cohort to which they're closest to. And we find that the method still operates that way. We still get persistence. It's a little bit higher actually, because they're unique funds that are outperforming, but generally the method still works if you want to do it that way. If you want to lower your correlation cutoff, for instance, for joining funds together, it'll still work.
And that leads me on to a question, let's call it about portfolio construction. So in the paper, you talk about taking the 15 largest cohorts, identifying the candidates with stronger alpha and good persistence of alpha by extension, and combining those in a portfolio context. Were there any other insights to portfolio construction? That's a, you know, a pre-specified rule, if you will, take the largest 15, et cetera. Were there any other insights to portfolio construction that you could draw from your analysis?
I would say about that particular test, that's really a proof of concept, because you can measure an alpha and say it persists, but that doesn't tell you how it'll do in a portfolio context. By forming 15 groups and taking the best one or two fund in each and putting them together, you're saying, okay, this appears to add value to portfolio performance if used. We do not for a moment believe that's the way you would actually use it, by forming the top 15 groups. You would actually target the strategies you want and use this to help you identify the funds in that strategy and what the best performing funds are. The other thing that I'd probably come back to in terms of use for portfolio construction is that idea you can form specific groups of hedge fund. I think we had 161 different hedge fund groups overall through the sample, and there was about an average of 21 funds in each group. So again, it's a way of dividing up the universe to understand it. And just like if you were trying to mix styles in an equity portfolio, you can mix strategies in a hedge fund portfolio to get strategy diversification, and this will help you.
So you mentioned equities there and portfolio construction in equities. Do you think this approach has applicability beyond the hedge fund space, let's say to long-only active equity managers?
No, unfortunately. This is one of the really interesting things is I actually had an honors student that was looking at this issue with global equity funds. He's trying to put the same methodology in and it didn't work nearly as well. I think there's a reason for that, and that is that in the hedge fund space, you do tend to have more distinct strategies. Whereas when you're looking at the equity space, there's less styles, if you want, and there's a lot more overlaps. There's not as distinct as a distinct group. You know, the spectrum from value through to growth, there's a lot of graduations in there, and I'm not sure you can form such distinct groups. So he's finding the groups, there weren't many groups, they were changing over time. It didn't have the distinction that we got in the hedge fund universe. So it works in hedge funds. It may work in other asset classes. I think it'll probably work where you do have distinct groups or distinct styles or distinct strategies within that universe.
Yeah, that's interesting because you'd hope that it had general applicability, but from your description about the smaller number of variables, explanatory variables perhaps, or the lesser distinction between the number of explanatory variables, yeah, that does make sense. What's next, Jeff? Have you got some other research on the boil that's possibly related to this or not at all?
Yeah, there is. There's. I did mention this came out of David Forsberg's PhD thesis, and we've currently got the another follow-on paper from the one we just haven't published in the FAJ, submitted to the FAJ as well. And that looks at whether capacity in hedge funds can be explained by cohorts. So the underlying thesis there is that capacity doesn't operate at the fund level. It operates at the strategy level. And indeed, that's what we find, that it's actually at the cohort level, when you get more AUM, that you start to see alpha drop off. And we find that the only time that that isn't the case is when you get those unique funds. They tend to have a relation between AUM and fund size, probably because they're unique. So another thing you would look at if you were going to use this approach is not only forming cohorts, but also looking at the size of those cohorts and whether AUM may have grown too large and the strategy as a whole will run into capacity issues.
That one sounds particularly interesting from the point of view of the recent environment, and recent could even be post-GFC environment, where the search for yield and the search for diversification in portfolios, particularly amongst institutional investors, has stepped up. And I think despite some of the disappointment in the delivery of hedge fund strategies, there has been a steady flow of capital probably putting pressure on capacity in some. So it'll be interesting to see what emerges from that. Are you anticipating with a prior any particular observations?
I would expect that would be the case. I'm pretty sure that if we extended our data period, that you might start to see some of that as we have seen hedge fund and in fact, active management performance drop off over time. There is also a paper looking at US mutual funds and find that the size of AUM in the industry as a whole appears to influence performance. So performance, one of the reasons why we might have seen an attenuation in active management performance over recent is the fact that the industry is just holding a larger portion of the market. So I'd expect that would happen in hedge funds as well, which leads on to an even more interesting debate is that how does that all work out as active management becomes less prevalent and indexing becomes more prevalent? Does that turn the ship back in the other direction?
Jeff, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you on this podcast. I know anybody and everybody out there who's listening to this in some form of lockdown will be willing the day when we can get together and do it in person. I know I certainly am for the day and for the joining together over Zoom. I think this worked wonderfully, and I really do appreciate you sharing those deep and thoughtful insights around the paper. Thank you again.
Oh, thank you, Ian. I really enjoyed it. And thanks to the CFA Societies of Australia for giving me the opportunity.
And that brings to a conclusion our inaugural podcast. On behalf of CFA Societies Australia, I'd like to thank Ian Patrick, CIO of SunSuper, for helping us bring this conversation to life. And to Jeff for your ongoing contribution to the journal. And indeed to our broader industry, we thank you. Have a great day, everyone, and be safe. Thank you all.